look at the world around me and kind of like, again, you remember Marty's lesson from last week and the fallen world? Or maybe you think about Eric's lesson and you think my body's decaying anyways. Maybe I would just think about life and think about the fact that I'm going to die anyways, or think about the fact that the world is broken anyways. So why bother doing anything? Maybe I'd just kind of be a bum and I'd fold my hands and decide, you know what? I'm not doing anything ever, because why does anything matter? I don't know. Maybe I'd think about my life and maybe it'd be this, actually. You drop down to verse 8. And in verse 8 it says, there was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring, depriving myself of pleasure? I don't know, maybe this is what my life would be. Where I don't even care so much about my neighbors and being better than my neighbors. In fact, I don't care so much about the world being so sad and depressing. Maybe I'm just somebody that doesn't care about anything except for myself and gaining stuff and having stuff. I don't know, so maybe my life would just be a constant pursuit to be better than other people, where that's the only thing I cared about. I don't know, maybe sometimes the thought might be that I would just kind of live with a lack of desire to do anything, because you know what? I look at famous people and they're really talented and I'm clearly not that talented, like y'all know me. Like, and so, you know what? Why bother doing anything? Because this is who I am anyway, so whatever. Or I don't know, or maybe my life would just be a complete disregard for anybody or anything because things are more important than people. By the way, you might think to yourself, well, no, Bill, you wouldn't be that. You'd be better. That's a lie. At best, this is what I would be. And it's not hard to see that, because look at the world around you. This is what people are. This is who people are without God. And maybe the reason why they are this way, you actually see in the first few verses of the chapter, where Solomon writes, and he says, then I looked at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun, and behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them, and on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. Maybe what would lead me to kind of live this sort of life is that I would look at the world around me, and I would look, and I would see two separate times he says that, and look at, notice what he looks at and what he sees. All he looks at and all he sees is oppression. He sees acts of oppression. And he sees tears of oppression. And he sees the oppressor. And if you actually notice, on both sides, what they had is that they had no one. And maybe that's just the way you end up living life. That whenever you realize that deep down inside, if I don't have God, so just imagine, I don't have anybody, then nothing matters. That if I don't have no one, then I have to be better than you, because I have no one. If I don't have anyone, then I might as well fold my hands and not do anything, because I don't have no one. If I don't have no one, then you know what? Then I might as well have possessions, because I don't have anyone. This is how he looks at the world. So he comes to this conclusion in the very next verse, where he says, you know what? As you think about that, then you know what ends up happening? I end up congratulating the dead, who are already dead, more than the living who are still living, but better off, better than the dead, better than people who are alive. Imagine, again, this is life without God. If I wasn't a Christian, maybe this is how I would think. Better than both of them are the people who never existed, because they've never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. If I wasn't a Christian, maybe this is what my life would look like. Which, by the way, if you notice verse 3, better off, better than both of them, is the one who had never existed. You kind of know what he's saying? Like, in this weird sadistic way, you parents, you're like the worst people in here. And if you have multiple kids, you're especially bad, because you decided to bring people into this evil world that there's nothing good, there's nothing in it. All right, so like, let's pause for a second. Have I been as discouraging as Marty at this point? I don't actually think his lesson was discouraging. I think something can be, as those are his words, I think a lesson can be sad and hard and still encouraging, which is what I think his lesson was last week. But here's the thing. The Bible isn't just a story about a fallen world. Like, you know that, right? You've read it. The Bible isn't just a story that this is the world, that your body's going to decay and then there's nothing else. In fact, at the end of both Eric and Marty's lesson, they kind of hinted at this idea that there's more than just this terrible oppression, this evil world. In fact, because as you read the Bible, what you actually notice that the Bible isn't just a story about a fallen world. The Bible wants to show you a fallen world to get to this story, to this gospel story. And in fact, whenever you read the gospel, whether you're reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, something I've been thinking a lot about recently that just has stuck with me is that really all four Gospels, whenever you read the story, the actual message of the Gospel, you don't get till you get to the very end of the book. Have you noticed that? So you read the Gospel of Matthew, and in the Gospel of Matthew, what you end up having is you see all these teachings that Jesus does, and you see miracles, and you see the way he treats people, and you have these signs and these wonders and these places that he goes. But all of that happens to get to this concluding idea at the end of Matthew 28, where Jesus says that he now has all authority. And that in this gospel message, the good news about the fallen world that you live in is that Jesus has authority, he's king, and he's inviting everybody to be a part of the kingdom. And the way that that happens is that they have to obey the message of the king. And that in this good news, you know that Jesus is with us always. By the way, you read the Gospel of Mark, and Mark does the same thing. I talked about small fonts. I wanted to put more, and I had to take stuff out. But you read the Gospel of Mark, and it's the same thing at the end of Mark 16. You know, Mark 16, 16. Everyone who believes and is baptized shall be saved. What's the message at the end of that gospel? Well, the message is that Jesus wants his message preached everywhere, that there is salvation and condemnation, and that it depends upon what you do with the word of God, that the disciples will reflect Jesus and that Jesus is in heaven. In other words, he is ruling. Read the Gospel of Luke, and it's the same thing. That his words will come to pass, that if people repent, there's forgiveness of sins, and that he wants people preaching his name, that he calls them to be witnesses, and then he gets carried up to heaven, and their sorrow is now turned to joy. And you read the Gospel of John again, and it's the same idea that Jesus wants you to believe that he's the Christ, that he's the Son of God, that people who have never seen him now get to hear the message, and that there's a blessing in whoever believes in his name. So here's maybe like my premise here, that all four gospel books, or all four gospels, that the actual message of the gospel is found at the end of the book. So as you read the story and you see who Jesus is and you see what he does and you see what he teaches, it's all to convince you this at the very end of the book. Let me say that like Ecclesiastes, I believe, does the same thing. So super long introduction to talk a little bit about the book of Ecclesiastes. And to think through this idea of evangelizing through the book of Ecclesiastes. But again, the idea to evangelize means good news, to bring good news. And so you've read Ecclesiastes. We heard a lesson from it last week. You might be thinking to yourself, there is nothing good in that book. There is no good news in the book of Ecclesiastes. Remember, I said at the end of the gospel, so the point of the gospels is you have the whole book to get to this last point at the end, this last message. And in this message, you have the good news. My guess, or what I would like to present to you today, this evening, is that Ecclesiastes is doing the same thing. That everything you have in the book is all trying to lead you to this good news. So what's the good news in the book of Ecclesiastes? What's the gospel according to Ecclesiastes? And I'm going to obviously infuse some Jesus in here because he wasn't thinking about it, but I am. So, all right, verse 11. These are the last few verses of the book. The words of wise men are like goads, and the masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. Beyond this, my son, be warned. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether good or evil. All right, did you see the gospel message in there? You get it? I actually think there's a few different things he's saying here. I want us to notice maybe the first thing, and this is probably Larry's class on the names of God has done this to me here, so I can't not see things like these now. But I think maybe one of the first things you notice as he finishes up the book, that one of the big news he's trying to let you know is that God is. And so in a world where everything is passing by, in a world where everything is fleeting, where things are here and then they're gone, here's one news he wants you to know, that there is something that is stable, there is something that is firm, there is something that is, and that thing is Yahweh. And so he says all these, the wise words are given, if I gave you something, are given by one shepherd. And then he tells you to fear, that's present tense, fear God, because eventually God will bring everything into judgment. So there's this picture, there's this idea that God is. But it's not just that. You keep reading, and actually in verse 11, as he starts off, when he says the words of the wise men are like golds and the masters of collections are driven nails, but all this wisdom, all these commands, everything he has said in this book has actually come from one source. Kind of like when you had that picture up of the four gospels, and it says that all authority has come from one source. The message has come from one source. I actually think there's good news in that. Because now I don't have to live my life. Like, think about this. As a Christian, you don't have to live your life trying to figure out how to live your life. It's all come from the same source. From Scripture, from the Spirit. And I think that Solomon, whether he is realizing this or not by the Spirit, he's been inspired to write and to say that all wisdom, all the commands that he gives in this book, the ways that he's telling you to live, it's actually come from one shepherd. And I would venture to say that that's the good shepherd. And then you continue. And you notice what he says. He says the conclusion, and I think like if you just strip it down and you take the phrase for what it is, he says the conclusion is, you notice the conclusion, comma, when all has been heard, comma, is, but strip that away. What is the conclusion? Fear God and keep his commandments. Have you ever thought about how good that is? That God has now given you an objective way on how to live your life. It's not just that truth now comes from one source, but that this source is the objective truth on how you should live your life. And maybe my favorite part of all of this, outside of the God is that there is something, I think even at the end, you kind of notice that he is alluding to the fact that there is something after death. Because the whole book, he's talked about, you're going to die, you're going to die, you're going to die, I'm going to die, that's what's going to happen. But then he says, God will bring every act into judgment. And if I'm going to die, and that's all that there is, then why does judgment matter? Unless he's alluding to, there is something after death. And if you live according to the word in the objective way that God has commanded, and if you live listening to the source of the shepherd, and if you live believing that God is, there is a reward for those who live in God. So by the way, this is pretty much the end of Matthew, the end of Mark, the end of Luke, and the end of John. And so my question is, and this is what I want us to do with the rest of our time here, is to ask ourselves, what does the preacher, because this, again, this whole book is a sermon. What does the preacher do to lead us to this good news? There's a lot of things. I actually had like 8 and I tried to dwindle it down. A few of them could be coupled together. I'm trying to like be a little more concise. But I think everything I read in the book is trying to lead me to this point. That God is. That he is the source of truth. That his commands are objective and I need to follow them. And that if I do, there is life after death. So how does he get to this point? And maybe what are some tools for us as we seek to evangelize? What are some tools we learn from this book and from the preacher in this book? All right, so here's the first one, right? If this was like where I really struggled. If you read Ecclesiastes, you've noticed that there's a ton of questions he asks. In fact, over 30 questions. In 12 chapters. That's a lot of questions. He's just asking questions over and over and over again. And here are some of my favorite questions, right? So he actually starts the book by asking this question in chapter 1, verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Or you drop down to chapter 4. He says, in chapter 1, he says, is there anything of which one might say, see, is this new? In chapter 2, he says, I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? In chapter 6, you say, as is the fate of the fool, it will befall me. Why have I then been so wise? And then maybe my favorite one of all of them, he asks this question. And I think there's a reason. Remember, all of this is to lead us to the good news at the end. But he asks this question. He says, even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice, if he lives 2,000 years, and he does not enjoy good things, do not all go to the same place? All right, so maybe what's the first thing we learn from the preacher on bringing the good news to people? I think we have to learn to ask people weighty questions to get them to consider their vanity. I think as we think about conversations that we're having with people, too often I'm looking to just tell and I'm not looking to ask enough. I think one of the things you see here, and really one of the things you see with Jesus, is that there are questions that are being asked. And sometimes these questions are, hey, think about this. What's the answer? And really, there are questions that you know the answer to. But the questions are more than just, how are you today? How was work? Notice what these questions are. Like, yeah, there's a new commercial for a new car, but is anything actually ever new here? Everything's pretty much the same old thing. I mean, yeah, like you can be super wise, but at the end of the day, like, wise people and fools, they all kind of die. So what's the point of it? Like, do you see what he's doing? He's almost like he's baiting you to kind of with these questions. He's asking these questions to try to get you to think about something weightier. And again, like in our lives, in our conversations with people, is this what we are doing? Are we looking to ask people weighty, hard, difficult questions to get them to think about the vanity of the life that they're living? And really to consider the vanity of the world, the fallenness of the world that they're currently in. To keep reading in the book, and this is kind of everywhere. Oh, I didn't highlight one of them. Rats. This is kind of everywhere in the book. So there's like a ton of verses. So actually, there's two slides on this. But he writes and he says, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This I have seen is from the hand of God. Remember, for a book that's really a book under the sun, notice the theme here. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor, it is the gift of God. For in many dreams and in many words, there is emptiness. Rather, fear God. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider God. And there's a few more, and we won't read through all of these. But even you get to like the penultimate one, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God. And so by the time he finally gets to the end of the book, and he says, fear God is the conclusion when all has been heard is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act into judgment. You as the reader, you as the listener in the sermon, you're not wondering who is God, who is this being anyways, because what he has been doing the entire time is he's been infusing God in that conversation. So maybe think about this. When you talk to people, you know that there's a difference between I'm talking to someone and I'm talking to someone about God. You know, there's a difference between those two things, right? Like, you can talk to somebody for 30 years and never mention the Lord to them. That's very different than doing what the preacher is doing here, where he is looking for opportunities to bring God up. Notice, all he's doing is he's saying things like, yeah, I get to eat and I get to drink things. That's because God is good. And he's saying things like, yeah, you know what? I had a bad day today. I mean, I had a great day, and I'm happy when I have great days. Or in bad days, you know what? I had a bad day today. But then I think about God, and I think that God made both days, and that's okay. What he's doing, he's looking for opportunities to bring God up. And I think sometimes I have at least found that I have had conversations with people, and then like I randomly bring God up, and they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. What do you mean God? And I'm like, no, wait, I'm a Christian. What are you talking about? It's like, wait, you've never brought this up before. We've had conversations about baseball. We've had conversations about this and about that and about XYZ thing. Like, now you're talking about this God stuff. What is this about? By the time he says the conclusion, when all has been heard, fear God and keep his commandments, for this applies to every man, for God will bring into judgment. You're not surprised that the conclusion of the matter is fear God, because the whole book he's been saying God, God, God. Things come from God. It's God's gift. It's God's goodness. And as Christians, as we think about, again, bringing the good news to people, yeah, we ask weighty questions where we want them to think about hard and difficult things. But you know what? We also look for opportunities to bring God up. You ever been around, like maybe you are this person, and if so, I thank you. But you ever been around somebody that like, yo, how are you doing today? I'm doing good, thank be to God. I'm just going to say I'm good. Because in my mind, we're saying the same things. But they're being intentional about bringing God up in the conversation. And I think having that sort of mentality, having that sort of habit will go a long way. Whenever you're trying to invite people to Bible studies, or you're trying to invite people to church, or you're trying to actually talk about Jesus, the fact that this is not a surprise, because this is who you are. You always talk about God. That's just the person that you are. I think that's one of the things we see in the book here. But you keep reading, and this might be one of my favorite verses in this book. I think Heather sometimes makes fun of me because of this verse. In chapter 11, so towards the end of the book, he writes and he says, cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will find it. You know what that idea there of cast your bread upon the waters is? I'm not going to do it. But the idea is you have your bread and you are just casting it away. you're letting it go. You may see that bread again. You may not. All right, so how does this help us evangelize? How does this help us talk to people about God? I don't know about you, but like sometimes I can fall into the temptation of not giving. And I don't even just mean financially. I think, again, think about the real gift we're trying to give people. I think sometimes I find myself not giving because I am unwilling to make uncomfortable sacrifices. And what he is saying towards the end of the book is be willing to cast your bread upon the water. By the way, the idea of bread is something that you care about. You don't want to just give this up. And in fact, as you cast it upon the waters, you're not even sure this is ever going to come back to you. But as we think about being people who share the good news, about being people who evangelize, I think one of the tools that we can learn from this sermon of Ecclesiastes is that we have to learn to be willing to get uncomfortable and to make some sacrifices. And you might think to yourself, wait, but if I'm the person always trying to help, if I'm the person always trying to encourage, if I'm the person always trying to serve and always trying to do, am I ever going to receive anything? Will I ever get anything in return? You may not in this life, but you will. Remember Sewell's sermon from this morning? The three different kinds of people, the third group, Paul. He didn't get very much in this life. My guess is he got a greater return for the breads he casted upon the waters than a lot of people did because of the reward he has in the Lord. And so, again, sometimes I think that the fear of hard times prohibit us from giving of ourselves, giving of my time, giving of my efforts. Like, well, I want to, but you know, like the times that we live in, it's just hard. It's difficult. It's uncomfortable. We just have to be willing to give of ourselves. That's the idea of casting your bread upon the waters. You are making a sacrifice. None of this is comfortable. None of this is something you actually want to do. That's like the surprise. But you do it anyways. Because you know that eventually you'll have a return. And here's the beauty. If you're a Christian, let me ask you, the person that taught you the gospel, were you with them for the rest of your life? Some people, sure. I think about like all the people that played a role, conversations that I had with people, where they influenced me to serve God. Some people never received the bread that they casted. But the Lord is going to recompense them. And the idea here isn't, I'm going to cast the bread, I'm going to teach people, I'm going to try to evangelize, and if they just don't obey God after five studies, then I'm done with them. That's not the point. Even if they obey God and you live in another state, or I'm gone, or whatever the case may be, like God sees it and God will recompense us as he sees fit. And so be willing to make uncomfortable sacrifices for the sake of the kingdom. In that same kind of vein, you drop down a few verses later in chapter 11 to verse 3. And he says, if the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth, which is like, duh, right? And whether a tree falls towards the south or towards the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Just as you do not know the path of the wind and how bones are formed within the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. Verse 6, sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether the morning or evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike will be good. You notice what he says there in verse 3? So think about the picture, the image he's given there. If the clouds are full, what's good? Like you can bank that it's going to rain. It's kind of, if the clouds are full, they're going to rain. A tree falls, whether a tree falls to the north or a tree falls to the south, it's going to fall. You know kind of the idea he's trying to give? Some things are going to happen and you will not be able to control them. Like that's the idea. If the clouds are full with rain, can you say, no, clouds, just kind of hold it right now. It's going to rain. If a tree falls to the south, it just kind of fell. Some things are outside of your control. But here's sometimes what happens. Verse 4. So some things are outside of our control. And you have somebody who's just watching the wind. And they're like, it looks like it's going to rain today. And it didn't rain. And then the next day, it looks like it's going to rain today. I probably should, it's not a good day to sow. So they never do it. Do you notice the point that he's really trying to drive home here is stop waiting for the right moment to go out and sow the seed. If you'll spend your whole life saying right now is not the right time. It's never going to be the right time for you to talk to your neighbor. It's never going to be the right time for you to talk to your family member. It's never going to be the right time for you to talk to your coworkers. You're going to always be watching the wind and saying right now is not the time to do it. I should just wait because maybe tomorrow will be a better day. Maybe next week will be a better day. Maybe next month will be a better day. And think about just even this past year. Maybe 6 months ago, we didn't think this is where we'd be. Maybe we thought we'd be somewhere else. Maybe 2 years ago, we didn't think this is where we'd be. Point is, if you spent your whole life waiting and looking at the winds, you will always be paralyzed and crippled, and you will never do anything. So sow the seed now. Jesus didn't just say, all right, I'm going to look for the good soil, and all right, there, I don't know about... He just sowed the seed. And the seed will do what it's going to do. Because you don't know. My guess is that whenever y'all were supporting Roger 14 years ago, and he's talking to this 14-year-old kid, my guess is that they might have thought, well, maybe we should... Well, he probably should have, you know, I'm glad he didn't do it, but I could just imagine he would have thought, you know what? Him and Gardner, we should probably just wait a year or two to kind of see how this kid is going to pan out. Because right now, I just don't know. And there's some people here who knew me at that time. Like, yeah, I just don't know if this guy, I don't think the gospel's for him, really. Because I'm looking at him and he's just kind of ridiculous. And if all we're doing is we're waiting for the right time, like you never know when the seed is going to grow in someone and the change that it can produce in somebody. And so your responsibility isn't to watch the wind to figure out the right time. Our responsibility is to go and to sow the seed now. So how did you do that, right? So what opportunities? So my guess is everybody here has gotten an email from Mason this past week, a survey. Because Mason and Dave Hamlet and Dustin and Mike Kreck and some other guys are trying to help us as a body be more evangelistic. And to have more studies. And you might be tempted to tell yourself, I saw the survey and I want to fill it out, but really right now is not the time. It is the time. It just is. I would encourage you to go and fill that survey out. And figure out a way that you can help and that you can be fruitful in the work that collectively we're all trying to be a part of. Stop watching the wind. Start sowing the seed. That's really what he's trying to tell us to do. One of my favorite things about this book, when you think about everything he talks about and you think about how the book ends, as we talk about evangelism here, is that the word that he repeats over and over and over again in this book is vanity. In other words, it's a whisper, you know? You can't hang on to it. It's going away. You talking, if everything under the sun is vanity... Stick with me here for a second. If everything under the sun is vanity, then me talking to people about Jesus will ultimately cost me nothing. Because if I lose my job, it's vanity anyways. If I lose relationships, it's vanity anyways. If I lose money, it's vanity anyways. I can't keep it anyways. If everything under the sun is vanity, if everything under the sun is vanity, then me talking about Jesus to other people will ultimately cost me nothing. But me talking about Jesus to other people will ultimately give them everything. Because that's what he says at the end of the book. The conclusion, when everything has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments. For this applies, or this is the whole duty of man. It costs me nothing and it gives them everything. And what do you actually gain? Right? When you preach the gospel to somebody and they decide to obey, what is gained from all of this? Let's finish with these last few verses here in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. And let's go to verse 9 here. Because this is what happens whenever you decide. So like maybe you need some motivation. I know I was trying to tell you guys that this wasn't a discouraging lesson. So I put a brighter screen here. So y'all believe me, just in case you haven't believed me up to this point. So what's gained? And by the way, if you're a Christian, like this is your reality. So again, I don't know what my life would look like if I wasn't a Christian, because I am. I don't have to think very much about what I would look like, how I would behave, how I would talk. I don't have to think about that because that's not my reality. That's no longer my life. This is my life now. Chapter 4, starting in verse 9. He says, remember we gave those three pictures from chapter 4. And this is the new image. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? If one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. When you share Jesus with people, what do they gain? What do you gain? I think what you gain is you gain a new life where your labors are worth far more than anything else you would have done under the sun. Think again, you think about Sewell's lesson from this morning. If we could just bring Sewell back up here, and I won't do it, but if you could bring Sewell back up here, and we let everybody kind of think of a profession or think of a way of life, and say, all right, Sewell, like if I gave you $7 billion today, you could start over. You're a billionaire now, but you don't have Jesus. Would you take it? And well, Sewell, what if you were the greatest person at a certain skill, but you don't have Jesus? Would you take it? The answer would be no for anything. Because what you end up gaining, kind of like he says in verse 9, is you end up gaining a good return for your labor. That what you do now is worth so much more than anything you would have ever done. And I don't just mean that if you're an evangelist, by the way. If you are a Christian, your labors now, your life now, is worth so much more than it would have ever been worth before. By the way, and if you have two people working together with you, you'll be able to accomplish, and think about 400 people working together with you, we're able to accomplish so much more in the kingdom than we would have ever been able to do on our own in the world. But that's not the only thing. Because he continues and he says, if one falls down, what does he have? He has someone to lift him up. Remember verses 1 and 2? He was looking at the world and there was no one to comfort. No one to comfort. That's true in the world. That is not true in here. I don't know how many times I have fallen into sin, into just nonsense, into foolishness. And I am still here, not because I decided by my own strength and by my own greatness to get up by my bootstraps, but because of God's grace and because of people, I've been lifted up. What do you gain when you share Jesus with people? What do you gain if you decided to obey Jesus? Is you gain a family. Everybody in here, common believers, who will be there. This is a promise. I'm sure of that in this group. That if any of us were really hurting and would fall, like, that we, there are people here who would be here to lift you up. I've experienced it. This is what we gain. What you gain is you gain loved ones. And maybe you don't fall, but maybe you're just stagnating. You know? You just don't feel it today. But what do you gain? You gain people who help you keep warm. And what do you ultimately end up gaining? You end up gaining bonds with people and with the Lord, Romans chapter 8, that will never be broken, that death itself cannot break. I know this is not ultimately what he's talking about in chapter 4, but I think that in Christ and in Christianity, what he's referring to in verses 4 through 9 actually have their fulfillment. That in one another and in God, this is what we end up gaining. So here's the question for you this evening, even before we do the actual invitation part. I know y'all are waiting for that. Here's the question. Think about how much Jesus is worth to you. Think about how much your relationship with Jesus is worth to you. Think about how much your relationship with people who follow Jesus is worth to you. You have that because someone decided to share him with you. If you value that as much as you say you do, as much as I say I do, we have a responsibility to go to a fallen, broken world where people are decaying and to share this message with them. If you're a Christian who's been struggling with serving God and with being who God has ultimately called you to be, this is the message for you. That here, right now, you have a family of people who want to lift you up, of people who want to keep you warm, of people who want to make sure that you don't fall off. And that if you really want to be right with God, that our relationship and your relationship with God, nothing will break that. And if you're not a Christian, then everything we mentioned in the first part of chapter 4, that's your life. And you may have like gone through some mental gymnastics to tell yourself that it's not. But deep down inside, you know that that's life. It's an empty, lonely, sad life. that's fleeting and will end, and there'll be no reward afterwards. God offers you something so much better. Hopefully you've seen that, not just in this lesson, but you've seen that in your visits with us, in your conversations with us, in the ways in which we've treated you. And this is just a glimpse of what God is actually offering you. Why don't you decide to be a part of that tonight? You can do that by being in. So all of this, again, happens in Christ. You can do that by putting him on through the waters of baptism. If we can help you in any way, please come forward as we stand and as we sing.